All right.
Hi, it's Diane, and we are here on Tuesday, March 24th with the Noon Group. I've got Ellen and Teresa with us, and I think a few others might be joining us in a few minutes, but let's start with our check-in. Who wants to go first?
I guess I'll go. So the reason I've missed is my son is 16, and he has anxiety and depression along with ADHD, and he had a really difficult time in December and January on his depression medicine to a point where he was contemplating suicide several times a week. So we changed all his meds, and he seemed to be getting better, more controlled, and then he had an anxiety attack at school, which is the first time he's ever had one. He only started these like 6 months ago, where he would have these explosive, kind of like, I'd say they're almost like tantrums, but they're, you know, they're kind of like that.
Right.
And he had one at school, and so he had to go into a day program before they would let him back into school, that he needed to go to a mental health place for about a week. So it took a while to get through that system and to figure it out that, you know, sort of like the ADHD stuff has come around. Well, the mental health system is not there yet. And so just finding out what we had to do and when he could go and getting approvals. And he couldn't be at school and he couldn't be there. And then we had lots of snow here, which impacted everything.
Right.
And so he finally got in about a week and a half ago and did the program, was in and out in 4 days. Which is pretty short. They felt that he was, you know, doing well. And so then spring break came last week, and so we're trying to get back to, I guess, as he would say, a normal teenage life, and not get him too stressed with being behind work. He missed about 10 days of school total and midterms. And so he went back today, which is a good thing. Met with the teachers, and we're going to try to figure out a plan for him to get his midterms done but not get too stressed out. We've changed his AD, you know, as some of this can be the ADHD medicines, so we changed that in the midst of this. We changed, we've really been watching his eating habits. So it's been a stressful month and a half, and then our cat had to be put down last night. So it's just,
oh, sweetie.
It rains, it pours. It was very, very, you know, and I would say I was, you know, he was sad, but he handled it really well. So
yeah.
I keep saying today's a new day, and we're marching forward.
Well, this has got to be really stressful for you. How do you feel about how you're handling it?
90% of the time, I think I handled it pretty well. I had one or two, I would say, called sob breakdown the day that he was supposed to start the program, and it snowed, and so they were closed for 2 days, and then they bumped him because of the way the system works. He didn't get to go directly the next day that didn't snow. They bumped him like 5 days. So that was a breakdown from my side, and I think I've really tried to reach out and get out and do walks and just be outside, because I know my stress level affects his stress level. And
right.
Then, you know, my other son who doesn't, I didn't want him to feel like the whole world, you know, there wasn't some stability. So considering everything, I think I worked through it pretty well. I really did reach out to friends who were a support system through it just to listen.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like you handled it beautifully, trying to do some things to manage your own stress level. It's really tough when you're in those situations when you aren't in control and have taken the actions. And so, you know, the snow stops and you think that the next day is going to be he's going to get going, and then something happens with the bureaucracy. And you're such a get-it-done woman that there's moments where you feel like, okay, wait, what do you mean? I had this all taken care of. I was ready to check this off my list. And it makes it particularly difficult when we're in situations where we really don't have control. And so your stress in that is really normal and totally expected, Ellen. So,
yeah.
But it sounds like you had a lot of grace and a lot of patience and calm as much as you can. And it sounds like he's doing better, and you're excited about today being his first day back. Is that right?
Yes. He was nervous, and I was nervous for him, and we talked about it, and we talked about what he needed to say, and so, but yeah, I think it was definitely the school said, you want to be back here, and he said yes, so that's always a good sign.
Yep.
He only has two more months of this year, really, and I don't want him to, I told him we would reevaluate if it's the right school, if he's still feeling too stressed. It's part of the issue.
Well, and what I love about the way you're handling it, Ellen, is that you're trying to meet him where he's at. You're staying as calm as you can, and you're really managing it step by step. And it's interesting, and I'm going to preach to the choir for a second, because my guess is that your son's gift of anxiety is a gift, because you handle it very differently. Because you see that he's triggered. And what happens to those of us who don't have kids with anxiety is that we push and we push and we push and we push and we push. And that's often not what our kids need the most. And so this has been a balancing for you, because you're a very good at some kind of woman, but you've been very aware of the top priority for you, which is to help him to manage his anxiety and his stress through all of this. And you approach it very differently, I think, than many of us do. And I think, if I'm honest, I think it helps, because you don't push the same way as you would if he wasn't feeling the stress, or if he was sassing and talking back and resisting and some of the other stuff that a lot of us with older kids face on a day-to-day basis. Does that resonate?
Yeah, and I think I've learned that. I wasn't like – I certainly was a pusher, and I stepped back, I guess, towards the end of last year when I just saw – It just his grades and everything were plummeting, and I could see him going into depression. And so you evaluate what's more important. You say how this kid's whole life is going to be versus his grades, and you step back from the grades.
Yep. No, and I appreciate it's almost like a testimony there to Ellen. So thank you for sharing that, and I'm glad that you guys are doing okay. And would you do me a favor and send me a little note and let me know how your day at school goes today? I'm really... You're
sure.
In my heart today, so I'm sure we'll talk more. But so, Teresa, what's going on at your house?
Uh-oh.
Sorry, I forgot to turn you off mute. Mute. We had spring break last week as well, and my mom was here, so and she's really pretty good with my son. So, I mean, looking back, just not having the stress of school and homework. It was, the last couple of weeks have been overall pretty good. But he, you know, my kids were, I have four kids, and my son particularly loves to pick on his 10-year-old sister. And because there was so much together time, he was kind of antagonizing her and picking on her and being mean to her quite a bit. So that was very concerning, because she really is a pretty resilient kid, and we try to talk about it with her, but she did at one point become very upset. And, that was really hard for me, because, we can't make excuses for him, and he does understand that, he's got this ADHD and things are really hard for him, and, whatever. But so that really, that's kind of what's on my mind today, I think, on this phone call, is just that relationship and how to work more with him to not go after his sister so much, and how to work with her to help her without, belittling her emotions or making her feel like, you know, her feelings are not as important, you know, because, hey, he's got ADHD, so, you know. And then I've got 2 5-year-olds who just watch everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then I worry about, you know, what are they seeing? What do they think is normal? And, of course, we talk about it, you know, with them, and, you know, we talk about it to him, too, about how he's the oldest and everyone looks up to him, and is that, you know, what does he want to model for them? You know, what kind of people does he want his sisters to be? Because really, he's the sweetest kid ever to everybody else, except his 10-year-old sister, and he definitely has his moments with us, but...
So it sounds like, and I don't know if you want to, you know, tell me if you want to take aim on this, Teresa, but I mean, it sounds like this underarching theme is, you know, the interrelationship between your kids and just how your son's ADHD is impacting the entire family. If you were going to take aim, would it be more about the relationship between your son and your daughter and how to help them to manage their conflict, or would it be at a different approach?
Well, I think at this point I want to take aim at their relationship, or more specifically how he treats her. So I think it's coming from, like, I think he's jealous because she's, you know, she's sweet and she's funny and she has lots of friends and she's smart and, you know, she's so many things that he doesn't see himself as being. And, you know, so maybe the thing is to work on his self-esteem. I don't know, but I definitely...
Let me interrupt you for a second, because I mean, I think that your curiosity is fabulous, which is kind of getting under what might be going on for him. But so let's stay with the taking aim, because once we move to solution, then we're not taking aim anymore. So if the aim is how to support the two of them in having a different kind of relationship, what's your vision for the relationship? Is it less yelling? Is it more connection? Is it, if you could have one and not the other, what's really important to you?
To see him be kind to his sister.
Okay. So kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And does it go both directions, or is it really mostly him being kind?
Oh, it's mostly him. I mean, she can, when she reaches her frustration level, she can give it back, but he really does most, I'd say 98% of the instigating and the antagonizing, and, you know, she really does want to have a good relationship with him. So.
Okay. So how does that feel as a place to take aim?
It feels great.
Okay. Ellen, where do you want to dig in?
I want to dig in on trying to help to figure out with him how to make him have better self-esteem, because a lot of this is about that, about how he feels about himself. So I think it's an acceptance of who he is, but an acceptance and love of who he is. He has a lot of self-doubt.
Well, the word compassion kind of pops in for me, so it's like, how does he have compassion for himself?
Yeah.
Okay, so acceptance, self-love, compassion, higher, improving his self-esteem. So you want him to feel better about the situation he's in right now, and ultimately about him.
Exactly.
Okay. Great. Okay. So our topic today, interestingly enough, is, I'm on page 49. We're talking about failing forward. And this is always an interesting topic, because what we're going back to the critical response area of setting expectations. And as we've set expectations, we want to do it in the context of what's worked and what hasn't worked in the past. And what's really particularly difficult about this is that, you know, for us and for our kids, it's hard to be human, and a lot of us don't give ourselves permission to make mistakes, and a lot of us are really judgmental when things don't go the way that we expect them to go. We're judgmental of ourselves, we're judgmental of our kids, and a lot of times our kids get the same judgment. So if they go to this place of, oh, I can't believe I did it again, I'm never going to get it right, you know, they do a lot of that sort of, you know, beating themselves up piece of it if things don't go the way that they intended. And I think a lot of that comes from the playing field we lay for making mistakes. And I think that, you know, a lot of us were raised feeling that, you know, making mistakes wasn't great. A lot of us teach that. And I still remember, I can't remember the woman's name of it. She's the president or the creator of Spanx, which is one of the, you know, most innovative products ever, whether you like what they do or not, but it's very, very cool. And they've made a huge amount of money. She's a fabulous entrepreneur. But what she says that was one of the most powerful things when she was a kid was that every night at dinner, her dad would ask her, well, what did you fail at today? Because he knew that through making mistakes is how you learn. And you make things better or different by watching what didn't work. And I think that it's important for us, and it's important for our kids. And we talked a couple weeks ago about the fact that the solutions were in the successes. And it's also important for us to look at what doesn't work as a way to move the situation forward as well. And I think that part of what one of the things it says in the page here is we talk about a lot of times our kids do that defensive lying where they'll say something that is not true in order to avoid being wrong. And I think that the more that we can focus on it being okay to be wrong, the easier it makes life for moving things forward. And, I think about it, it's such a cultural thing. I mean, how many of us were raised in a situation where it's like, okay, you don't make mistakes. You don't, you know, it's, we get really upset when we make a mistake as opposed to going, okay, we made a mistake. What can we learn from it? I've been reading this book, or my sister-in-law recommended it to me. It's about a growth mindset. And about instead of a success mindset, it's about a growth mindset. So instead of when things don't go the way that you want to for your kids or for yourself, if you focus on, well, what did I learn from this? How did I grow from this experience as opposed to what went right or what didn't go right for us? It really does make a difference in terms of our ability to move the situation forward. So I'm going to encourage you guys to be really aware of when things don't work out the way that you want them to, either for you or for your kids, so that you can have conversations about them and move the situation forward, as opposed to burying them or judging them or getting frustrated about them, because it really can make a difference. I mean, I'm just thinking about even, you know, Teresa, if you were to pick apart some of the interactions where your kids were less than kind to each other and look at, really dig in and see what was going on in those instances and maybe learn from that and say, well, what can we do to set ourselves up for success in the next time? I think it could really make a difference. Same thing, Ellen, with some of the things that you've been through. So with that, what comes up for you guys about this concept of failing forward?
Well, I love it, and I definitely was raised to, and that mistakes were not good, and they were not, you know, it wasn't like we ever, like, when one of us made a mistake, I mean, we basically were just punished, and we knew that, you know, our parents, I mean, you know, not a little mistake, but if we made, like, you know, a big mistake or whatever. And it was, we never, like, talked it through or anything, and we knew our parents were disappointed in us, and, you know. And so I think, like, sometimes I unfortunately have carried that mindset just because that's how I was raised, because still today I don't like to make mistakes, even though I can step back and be like, okay, so that time this didn't work, so I won't do that next time. Instead, I'll do this. But I listened to that webinar on resilience that you all had last week, and I felt like some of that kind of played into this topic. Yeah. And he talked about how, you know, when your child makes a mistake, you know, sometimes you can't find anything positive to say about the mistake. He said, so the positive is then you sit down with them and you process, and then you say, you know, you did a great job working through that, you know, and now you know what to do next time, and, you know, I know that you're going to be able to do it. And so I've kind of kept that in the back of my mind as a good strategy that I need to start using with all my kids.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and isn't it interesting how we, you know, so many of us were raised that way, as you described that, it sounds very familiar. And yet, we all make mistakes. I mean, every single person on the planet makes mistakes. Little ones, big ones, I mean, it's part of what happens in life. And instead of normalizing it, it becomes something to avoid. Ellen, what would you add?
So I think this is one of those things that I actually feel like I'm pretty good at with him. And I think he does, we do talk about, you know, people make mistakes and you move on from it. The one thing I'm not, and, you know, there is a learning of what you did. I think the thing I'm not so good about is sort of the next step is we'll say that and he'll do that. But then when the same mistake is made a couple times, then I start to get like, you know, why aren't you, you know, we've talked about this and you acknowledge a mistake, but why do you keep making the same mistake over and over? And so I'm not sure I'm addressing that correctly. And that's something, you know, I have to figure out when he does.
So let me ask. So why do you think he does make the same mistake over and over again?
He'll say, because I'm a kid. And I mean, I guess I don't know exactly why, to be honest, but.
Well, and so, if we go back to that concept of assuming best intention, and I know both all your kids are great kids, and they want to do really well. And so if they're not successful, it's because they're having a hard time.
Yeah.
And if they're making a mistake, it's because there's a disconnect between the expectation and their ability. And so do they need a different expectation? Do they need a scaffolding? Do they need some kind of support or structure? If they continue to make the same mistakes, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome.
Right.
So if our kids are continuing to make the same mistakes, this is the opportunity to fail forward. So it's a clear indication that something's breaking down. So give me an example, Ellen, of where he continues to make the same mistake.
One of my big beefs is when he just doesn't do a homework assignment at all, and so he gets a zero. And, you know, the first few times I'd be like, yeah, I understand, you know, you read the thing wrong or you weren't in the mood. And I said, but, you know, it's important. A zero is huge on a grade, you know, versus at least if you attempt it and get something in, you'll get credit for trying to do it. And he'll be like, yeah, I made a mistake. And so it'll happen again. And I'll say, you know, happened again. You know, what can I do to help you? I try to put a, you know, is there something I can do to encourage you or remind you? And he'll be like, well, you can remind me, so I do. But then sometimes the next day I'll get a homework report that he didn't do it.
Right. So I mean, the challenge is that our kids are in that transition phase between, you know, owning it and needing support. And so we're doing this dance every time where it's, you know, how do I hold him accountable and help him at the same time?
Right.
So when you do a little detective work and look at what's working and what isn't in terms of capturing homework and starting homework, because it's what, 12 steps of homework we talk about. I don't know if you remember the 12 steps. I don't know them off the top of my head. But, you know, did they capture it? Did they bring it home? Did they get started on it? Did they follow through on it? Did they bring it back to school? Did they turn it in? You know, those are the big kind of chunks in the whole thing. And so if you get really clear and see, you know, is there a pattern to why he misses homework? And really figure out, is it you know, he consistently misses engineering assignments. I'm making that up because that's one of the problems at our house. But it's like, so what, you know, if you get to do some detective work, what's going on? Well, you find out that the kid that sits next to him talks incessantly, and so he just doesn't even hear that the teacher's making the assignment, and he consistently misses the assignment. So you learn from that and put a system and structure in place around that. You know, maybe there's something else going on in math class, and there's something else going on in language arts or whatever it is. But it's about really digging in and looking at, well, what's leading to the failure? Not just, okay, you failed and learned, but it's like, well, what, where was the breakdown really? And that's where that tool of curiosity comes in, because you can say, well, you know, what really happened here? And sometimes it is, I was just tired and I didn't do it. And so then the question is, sometimes you're going to be tired. What do you do in those instances when you're really tired and you know that you don't want to do your homework and your tendency is to pretend that you don't have any? And the longer you pretend, the more true it becomes, and all of a sudden you really don't have homework, right? And that right. trip from the back door of school when you know in your head what the list of homework is, you know, you get on the bus or you get home, and it's like by the time you get home, you're so tired, you're like, okay, wait, no, I really don't have any homework. And it's literally what happens in your brain. So in those moments, there needs to be a gap or a system or a structure in place to make sure that that magical thinking doesn't take over. Because that was just one example. But so how could you apply some of this, Ellen, to this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of sort of the managing of what he's going to get done. I think where he has his biggest issues is English, because he really hates to write. And I think it was on one of your pages that it talked about when you know, it's difficult for these kids if they think that they're going to fail at it, it's difficult to get started.
Yep.
If they think they're, you know, and so it's a hard, but that's certainly something, you know, he's got to do. I can coach him, but he's got to write it, especially in his, you know, he's in 10th grade. But I think his hesitation of even getting started it's so overwhelming to him. Even though they break it down at school, I think his school is really good at saying, this is what you have to do tonight, just this little section, but sometimes he'll still procrastinate and he'll, you know, if they have the assignment that's due in a week, even I say work on a little bit every night, he just has so much difficulty starting it because he knows it's, you know, three paragraphs in a week and he just doesn't, it's just too overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, and it's hard. But your intuition is good, which is, you know, how do you help him to break it down? How do you help him to look at it? I'd encourage you to begin to use the word instead of how can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
Focus it on him. It's like, what do you need to make this work? What do you need to make this happen? You know, and start doing that shift, because part of what I find our kids resist is if they're like, I don't need you to help. You know, it's like that mindset. I can think about what I might need in terms of support, even if it's something I'll ask you for. But
yeah,
if
I do,
you know,
I do say that
subtle
to him, actually. I have started, since we joined, started to say that to him. But most of the times he'll just say, just remind me, and I will remind him. But, you know, I think this, we were talking about sort of the global picture. Sometimes it's the fact that, you know, in his world is his mind. English is a paper is not important. You know?
Yeah, and so the question is, how can you, so the question with him is, you know that your brain's not kicking in because, number one, you know you don't love writing, and number two, there's not a real motivation because you aren't connecting the dots.
Yep. Yeah.
And I know that you want to do well in your class because ultimately, you know, you're the kind of kid that wants to do well. Knowing that your brain needs a motivation and it needs some structure, what do you think you could put in place that would help you to be more successful in getting these assignments done? Does that resonate?
Mm-hmm.
Teresa, what about you? What kind of comes up around this whole issue of failing forward?
um, Well, you know, just the whole thing of, you know, learning from your mistakes instead of repeating the same one. But that could apply to how we handle when Connor makes mistakes as well as his mistakes, because I don't know that maybe we always handle it the best, because it's so easy to get frustrated when the same thing is happening, and trying to find that the motivator for him, because it's not great. I mean, he loves to learn and he does want to do well in school, but grades just don't really mean that much to him. You know, he just doesn't care. So really, I think he cares more about the teachers and what the teachers think of him. And then he's got, you know, and a lot of his teachers can see past everything and, you know, are very, you know, in comments to me, they definitely, you know, they get him and they enjoy working with him and everything, but not all. And so I don't know. I was just really listening to what you were saying and taking a lot of notes. Just more like how you were saying, like, you know, just really thinking about, you know, what's leading up to the mistakes. Why does he keep making the mistakes, and maybe changing something to make whatever the task is more, like, so that the expectation more meets his ability, and, you know, then, you know, asking him what he needs from us to, you know, to be able to be successful at whatever that task is, instead of saying, you know, how can I help, or just doing what we think we need to do to help, but, you know, asking him.
So back to your situation of the conflict between your kids. When you get curious, what's going on?
I don't understand what you mean. You mean what's going on
in that moment when all of a sudden they're getting along, and then all of a sudden they're not getting along. What are some of the things that are happening? Is it a trigger? Is it a...
Well, sometimes it could be, you know, like, you know, if my daughter comes in and says something like, you know, oh, Mom, so-and-so invited me over to her house this weekend. Or, you know, something else good. Like, oh, you know, I got a 100 on my math test, or... something like that. So sometimes it's, you know, her coming and, you know, sharing with us, like, some kind of good news or something. But then sometimes, I mean, he just comes downstairs and she's already, you know, downstairs eating breakfast, and she won't say a word to him, and he'll just walk in the kitchen and be like, is that what you're wearing today? Oh, my gosh, everyone is going to make fun of you. That is the dumbest outfit I've ever seen. You know, like,
right.
She's... absolutely nothing. He just starts. So
right. So it sounds like part of it, so one of his triggers is when she's celebrating, it makes him feel less than. And so his solution is to lower her, because then that'll make him feel higher. I don't know how to say that. Does that resonate?
Right. No, I agree with that.
And then the other time, it's like he comes down, and who knows what was going on in his head a moment before. I mean, maybe he had a hard time tying his shoes, and he was beating himself up, and he comes downstairs, and it's like, I need to attack somebody because I feel bad about myself right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like if you're getting curious, what's really going on underneath it is his self-esteem has taken a dip, and his action in response to that is to attack, which is a pretty normal thing to do, because if I can make you feel bad, then it makes me feel, for a moment, at least it makes me feel better.
Right.
And so the question is, you know, how, is he at a place developmentally where he can see that? And can you help him find something else to do when he doesn't feel good about something that happens? Because he's in this place where probably a mistake has been made and he's trying to feel better, and it may tie into this whole feeling forward thing.
Well, I'm not sure, because I actually talked to him about it last night. But I don't know maybe I didn't approach it the right way, but I just, you know, I was telling him how at one point over the break his sister just started crying, and, you know, she was like, all I want is for him to be nice to me. Why can't he just be nice to me? Why can't he ever, you know, just tell me he's proud of me when I do something good instead of always telling me how he's so much better? And, you know, I was telling him about what she had said, and I said, you know, how does that make you feel? And he's like, well, he's like, not that good. And I said, you know, just in the course of conversation, talking about that. And then I said something like, well, you know, is it that you're jealous, you know, when something good happens to her, when she does something well? And he immediately got very defensive and was like, I'm not jealous of her. There's nothing to be jealous of. I'm so much better than her. But again, maybe, yeah, I shouldn't have said, are you jealous? I don't.
Well, my guess is that he probably isn't self-aware enough to see that. And very few of us want to know. When somebody tells us we're doing something that, you know, nobody wants to hear that, in all honesty. But the thing, mm-hmm. So what I'm wondering, this kind of popped into my head, was a structure we put in place in our house when we had a lot of kind of criticism going on. And the rule was, if you say anything negative about anybody else in the family, you had to turn around and say three things that were positive. So we were talking about that 3-to-1 ratio and about how to have, I think we talked about that, I don't know, it was the last call or this call before that, where, you know, you've got to try to keep the balance of praises to corrections in at least that 3-to-1 ratio. And so whenever my kids would say something snarky to the other one, we always said, okay, well, what, say three nice things about your sister right now. And one of the things that kind of is a twist that kind of came to me as you were talking was, could you set it up so that he has to say 2 nice things about his sister and he has to say 1 nice thing about himself? So he's also building up his own self-esteem. So it's not just, oh, gosh, here I got to go praise my sister again. She's already fabulous. I'm not going to say nice things to her. But you're doing that sort of spin on it where it's, you know, instead of saying unkind things to everybody, we say kind things to everybody. So what resonates in that for you?
Well, I love that idea. I'm not sure how cooperative he will be, because sometimes when he is ugly, it's like he's in what I like to call his dark mood, where,
yep,
he is just not pleasant to be around. And so, I mean, does it work to give him a, because a lot of times when he's like that, then we have to, you know, ask him to go outside and shoot baskets for a few minutes or go up to his room.
Yeah,
or, you know,
that makes perfect sense, because what you're highlighting is the difference between a triggered kid and a snarky kid, right? So if he's really triggered, he's in fight or flight, and the part of him that remembers that he likes part of his sister is not going to kick in. You're right. So how do you know when he's more in that triggered place versus when he's just a little bit snarky, for lack of a better word?
I would say it's kind of like his affect almost. I mean, it's almost, this sounds really out there, but it's almost like you can just see like this, I don't know, just like the expression on his face, and he just resonates kind of unhappiness, you know, and sometimes he wakes up in that kind of mood, or sometimes it just comes upon him. But I mean, you can definitely tell. He definitely has like an affect or something where, you know, I can see. Because last night when we were talking, he was being snarky. It's totally different than, say, like when he might come downstairs in the morning already in a not so great mood and then just light into her without any antagonizing or anything on her part.
Yeah. Well, so that takes us back to the whole trigger management and what, and did you guys, when you guys were, when we talked about triggers in the class, did you do any work with your family around identifying triggers and what we do as a family when somebody gets triggered? Did you do any kind of family conversations around that, Teresa?
Well, we did, and we set up a code word, and then it just, every time we used it, it just, there was just no buy-in from anyone except me, I'll be honest with you. So that's why I'm really interested. I saw the next webinar is about the family meetings and how to make them, like, really working to get everyone to buy in.
Yeah.
Because I need that information because, no, even my husband, like, there's just no, you know, in his mind, when I grew up, my parents set the rules and they told us what was going to happen and that's the way it should be. And, you know, he just doesn't believe in these family meetings. So there's no buy-in really from anyone except for me. And I mean, my three girls go along with it, but the person that really needs it isn't buying in at all. And then I don't have that support from my husband either. So.
Well, and so that's a good point. And in fact, I'll make sure Elena and I haven't talked about completely what that full presentation is going to be about. But I think that your comment about how to get your spouse engaged if they have the perspective that parents are in charge when they just tell their kids what to do and they should listen and we shouldn't have to have a family meeting kind of thing. That's a good one. So what do you think? So let's fail forward. So this is going to be the exercise we're going to do today, guys. So you had a situation, you talked about triggers, you set up a code word, and it totally bombed.
Mm.
What did you learn from that?
That maybe that wasn't the right strategy for my family, so maybe we need to go back and figure out something different, like instead of a code word.
So what happened when? So what happened when you used the code word? How did everybody react?
Well, when we had to use the code word on my husband, he was just basically like, he's like, "No, that's not for me. That's only for Connor." And you know, don't tell me that I'm getting upset because
he had triggered. So the code word triggered him even more.
Yes, and I'd say the same thing happened with my son when we used it with him. It just made him, you know, mad. So,
yeah. Well, and so I guess that that's the question is kind of what you're trying to do if you're trying to solve an issue. So if you take all the personalities out of it, and the three of you are sitting down at the table and saying, okay, the problem is that when one of us gets triggered, I mean, communication is not effective. And so we've got to have a way to stop everything until whoever's triggered calms down. And sometimes it's me, and sometimes it's dad, and sometimes it's you, right? So it's just any of the three of you could be triggered.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know that the code word also can be a trigger or that there's not a level playing field, what would it take to kind of go back to the two of them and say, what do we do when somebody does get triggered in order to not have it end up in a hot mess where we're all triggered?
So basically you're saying that would be the step that I need to take.
How do you think that conversation would go? Do you think that the two of them are developmentally prepared for that conversation?
Did you get a question there?
I don't know. I think, well, I hope my husband is developmentally prepared for that conversation. Um, I think it would really depend. I think I would have to catch my son in a good mood, and then, because I think if he would participate with a good attitude, then that would kind of change my husband's perspective on it.
So the buy-in step is, look, it doesn't work at all when any of us is triggered, and so we've got to find a way to create the space for the person to calm down. And usually when you're triggered, nobody knows that you're triggered. So it's really important to not have a conversation when anybody's triggered. So I don't know in your house if that's easy to do or hard to do. Sometimes in our house it's hard to find a moment when somebody's not triggered. But so how do you think you might approach it with both your husband and with your son?
I would go to my husband first and, you know, ask him, you know, what do you think about, you know, sitting down with Connor and the three of us, you know, talking about what went wrong with the code word and, you know, maybe coming up with a different idea so that he maybe had more buy-in. Instead of me just saying, we need to sit down and have this discussion.
Right. So what is his motivation to participate in some sort of trigger management?
Well, at this point, I would say he would probably do it just to make me happy.
Okay.
Because I don't know that he sees his part in it as a problem. So it would be more, I guess, to keep me happy.
And so how much of a motivation is that for him?
It depends. I mean, it can be a strong motivation for him. We've just had so many struggles with Connor, and we have such different viewpoints. So
here's the thing. I mean, it's like it's about making sure there's some kind of motivation. And the reality is that Connor may be at the point where developmentally he's still motivated by making mom feel good and doing what mom asks. And at some point he's going to get to the point where most of our teens do, which is I could care less what mom thinks. I've got to have a motivation that's mine. And at that point, if they don't see how it helps to stay calm, you help them to see how it helps to stay calm by saying, I'm not going to engage with you at all until you've calmed down, and I'm happy to help you come up with a solution for how to calm down. Because usually if they're triggered, it's because they want something, or they want something to not happen.
Uh-huh.
So if you just say, look, I'm not engaging at all until we're all calm, and I would encourage you to use that language, because if you say until you're calm, it's suddenly you're pointing the finger and they get frustrated. But then it's kind of like, we can problem solve when everybody's calm. And that's the house rule. We don't problem solve unless everybody's calm. Then he wants to be calm so that the problem can be solved, because he has some chance of getting what he wants if the conversation continues. Does that resonate at all?
Yes.
Okay. Ellen, I hear you in the sidelines here. Is there anything you would add? Or question you would ask? I don't know if you have thoughts for Teresa.
I would say we have some of the same dynamics. So, and I tend to be like, everybody needs to calm down before we can talk. And so I do think that helps diffuse. It still happens, but he knows that for us to work it through, he's going to have to calm down. And I've learned not to get angry or, you know, just to kind of let him get to that point before we talk.
Okay. All right. Well,
and
I'm looking at our...
So what's interesting is, a sibling, we have two boys. And I remember, my son's older now, but I remember going through that phase where Austin, who's the older son, would kind of start these things with my younger son. And some of it, I think, as we some of it is ADHD and some of it is just sibling stuff. And it's not to say that that's good, but I've watched them outgrow that. I don't know if it's personalities, but I've watched that go away over the last couple of years.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm cognizant of our time. Let's take a few minutes here and do our wrap-up, and we can talk a little bit more as we're doing that. But so I'm on page 50. Four questions. So what did you focus on? What did you pay most attention to during the conversation today? What became clear? What takeaway did you have? What's a realistic action step for you to take? And what do you need to do to set yourself up for success with the action? So take a minute, write that down, and I would love to hear from both of you in terms of what your takeaways were and what you want to do in terms of action.
So my takeaway is I think I'm good at not making a big deal about mistakes, but I don't think I'm really good about the growth aspect where you were talking about of what did you learn and from it. I don't think I really engage in that conversation. I'm like, okay, no big deal, you made a mistake, but I think I really want to work on, okay, so what did you learn from this and learn from doing this so we can move forward. So it's the forward thing. So I want to take action on, I think he dwells on his mistakes, and help him to see that life is about partially is that those are the risks, you know, everyone will make mistakes, and it is the learning from it and the growth that you get. So I might have to find what that book is that you're reading.
Oh, I'm happy to.
Yeah.
I'm happy to give that to you. I'll post it in the forum. Can I give you a caveat?
Yeah.
Again, the whole, you know, learning. So when you talk about learning from your mistakes, make sure you're not setting yourself up for, okay, why didn't you learn from your mistakes? Because he will continue to make the same mistakes over and over again, even if he does learn from them. I mean, on some level, it's a developmental challenge. So just know that it's important to fail forward, but he may not be ready to get to the forward part that you are expecting. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Teresa, what about you?
Well, I think my takeaway is that, you know, Connor and my husband need a motivation. And I think the action step for me to take is to take your advice, and when they get upset and come to me to say I'm not engaging with you at all until we're all calm, and then, you know, together we can problem solve when everybody is calm. I don't really know how I can set myself up for success. I guess maybe I need to write that on an index card and put it in my pocket.
So a reminder of some sort to kind of make sure. What would you write down?
Well, you know, like just do not engage until everyone is calm.
Great. Yeah, and it becomes a mantra. And it sounds like, you know, an important first step is to find a way to have a conversation with your husband to get buy-in.
Right.
So when do you think you can do that?
Have the conversation with my husband?
Yep.
Well, hopefully we can do it. Hopefully one night this week. We kind of have a lot going on where we're all going in different directions this week, but I would like to do it as soon as possible. Again, it's finding the right time when he's not, you know, stressed out from just walking in the door from work and dealing with an hour of traffic and all that. So,
so what does that mean practically?
It just means, you know, in the right time. So I may have to wait a couple days.
Yeah, I was going to say, what, so when are some times in the next 5 days that you might be able to have that conversation?
Well, you know, in the evening after the younger two are in bed, when things tend to be a little more calm. So, you know, once he's had a little bit of time to relax, he's had some downtime to himself.
Okay. How's that feel?
It feels good. I just, I'm a type A person, so it's just going to be on my mind until I get it done.
Of course, because you're like, now that you know what you want to do, it's like really easy to say, okay, I'm going to do it, but you know that it's, you can't do it now, which is why I think, you know, the suggestion to say, okay, when are some times that I could do it, and then, you know, setting yourself up for success by saying, okay, I'm going to do it this time, or this time, then you know that you've got, you know, a timeline and you've got a plan and that sort of stuff.
Uh-huh.
How does that shift it for you a little bit?
Yeah.
Good. All right. Any parting thoughts before we wrap up? Great conversation today, guys.
Nope. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. So we are on again. Let me just double check because we've got spring break coming up for the next couple weeks for folks. We are meeting again on April 14th is our next call. So just want to pay attention to the fact that we are not meeting for the next 2 weeks.
Okay.
Okay, and then the Lifeline call will be the 21st, the week of the 20th is when the Lifeline call will be. Good. All right, guys. Thanks for your call today. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.